This is the 2010 West Coast School of the Prophets. Our theme for the weekend is the prophecy of Ezekiel 38. Our study leader is Brother Roger Lewis of New Zealand. This is session 15, entitled, Why Not an Arab Confederacy Against Israel? Brother Roger.
Well, tonight then, we're going to look at the question, as displayed here, of why not an Arab confederacy against Israel? And in the course of doing that, what we hope to do is to clarify the role of the Arabs in the latter days. Because there's certainly no reason why there both shouldn't be and couldn't be a further Jewish... We've never suggested that it's impossible for such a battle to occur, and certainly not even that it's not possible biblically for such a battle to occur. All we've been saying for the purpose of this weekend is that we need to get clear in our minds that we don't think it is the great controversy of the time of the end, which is not quite the same as saying that there'll never be another Jewish-Arab battle of any sort, because there might well be. And in fact, my personal view is that another Jewish-Arab battle might in fact be helpful towards certain of the things that we envisage, even the situation of Ezekiel 38, to come to pass. But in fact, we don't know because we can't be sure. Now, one of the things that I've always tried to do in Bible study, and maybe it's just been the particular method that I've adopted for purposes of Bible study, and I've certainly done it for many years, is I suppose that you can handle many things thematically, but I always try and have a golden line of something that runs through the talk. And the reason for that is that people grasp a story much better if there's a line or an idea that seems to run through like a thread. In order to do that, you've got to be committed to doing that properly, which means that sometimes you might remove extraneous material because it's not going to be helpful to the unfolding of that particular line of approach that you've decided upon. So one of the dilemmas that we have in doing Bible study is always trying to figure out what that is, because in fact you could tackle this as a lecture, for example, from several different angles, couldn't you? Why not? What does the Bible say about an Arab confederacy against Israel at the time of the end? You could adopt several different biblical approaches to doing that. So I'm only going to adopt one tonight. It's one that I have done before, and so I feel comfortable and familiar with it, but I'm not sure that all of you will be, and so I hope that you might find it helpful, again, in terms of a line of biblical reasoning. Well, where this begins is actually back in Genesis chapter 12. Because you remember that in Genesis 12, we've got the moment in time when Abraham first comes into the land of promise. And in Genesis chapter 12, he arrives in the land. And verse 7 says that Yahweh appeared unto Abram and said, unto thy seed will I give this land. And there builded he an altar unto Yahweh. So that's the first time the promise is made in the biblical record. Unto thy seed will I give this land. And of course, this land, well, he's in the place called Shechem, verse 6. And Shechem, obviously, is right in the heart of the land of Israel. So when the promise came to Abraham, or Abram as he was then known, in Genesis 12, verse 7, unto thy seed will I give this land, we're very much talking about the very land of Israel, because he was right in the heart of the land at the time that promise was given to him. And again, for example, chapter 13, doesn't it say, verse 15, all the land which thou seest to thee will I give it unto thy seed forever. So it was quite a simple promise, really. Again, chapter 15, verse 18 says, in the same day, Yahweh made a covenant with Abram, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land. And now the dimensions of the land are expanded even further than perhaps Abraham anticipated, because the promise was from the river of Egypt and unto the great river, the Euphrates. It's quite possible that Abraham walked all of that, incidentally, in his lifetime. From Ur of the Chaldees down into Egypt in time of famine and back again, he might have walked the length and breadth of the dimensions of the land that was promised to him, which in fact is what God told him to. Arise, walk through the land and the length and breadth of it, for I will give it unto thee. It's distinctly possible that Abraham did that. And were the story to end there in Genesis, it would be pretty simple, really. This land, the land that we're talking about, the land of Israel, was promised to the seed of Abraham. It was promised to Abraham as well, but to his seed. But there was a problem. And the problem was that in Genesis 16, we're told at the end of the chapter, in verse 15 of Genesis 16, and Hagar bare Abram a son, and Abram called his son's name, which Hagar bare, Ishmael, and Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bare Ishmael to Abram. And so Genesis 16, verses 15 and 16, is about the birth of Abram's firstborn son, whose name is Ishmael, the son of Hagar. But when we come to Genesis chapter 21, you'll remember that the record says in verse 1, "And Yahweh visited Sarah as he had said, and Yahweh did unto Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bare Abram a son in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken to him. And God called the name of his son that was born unto him whom Sarah bare to him, Isaac. And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac, being 8 days old, as God had commanded him. And Abram was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born unto him." And the problem was that unfortunately, Abram had two sons to two mothers, both of whom claimed to be the seed of Abraham. So when the promise came, "Unto thy seed have I given to this land, unto thy seed have I given this land, unto thy seed have I given this land," the problem was, who was the seed? Because now there are two sons, both the seed of Abraham, who both claim that land by virtue of that promise. Mind you, the Bible itself gave the answer to that, didn't it? Because in Genesis 21, as we've read together tonight, it says that Sarah, verse 9, saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, which she had borne unto Abraham, mocking. Wherefore she said unto Abraham, "Cast out this bondwoman and her son." Interesting, you know, that in the margin, you'll notice that that's quoted in Galatians chapter 4 and verse 30. Now, don't turn it up, but the thing I want to draw your attention to, and this may be helpful in terms of understanding the spirit of Sarah on this occasion, but when that passage is quoted by Paul in Galatians, he says this in Galatians chapter 4, verse 30, "Nevertheless, what saith the Scripture, cast out the bondwoman and her son." The Scripture, says Paul. But it wasn't actually the Scripture, it was Sarah's words. Ah, but that's the whole point. Sarah's words were counted as Scripture. So when Sarah said what she did in Genesis 21, verse 10, "Cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac," the Apostle Paul said, that's Scripture. What that woman said is Scripture. And he quotes it as such in Galatians chapter 4. And that was right, wasn't it? Because even though the thing was grievous in Abram's sight because of his son, verse 11, God said unto Abraham, "Let it not be grievous in thy sight, and because of the bondwoman, in all that Sarah has said unto thee, hearken unto her voice, for in Isaac shall thy seed be called." So God himself made answer in the matter. In the end, it wasn't Abraham's opinion at all as to who the promised seed was. It was God's sole prerogative to say that Isaac is the promised seed, through whom the promise comes and unto whom the promise belongs. This land belongs to the seed of Abraham through Isaac, not through Ishmael. God's judgment in the matter. And just as an aside, which again you might or might not know, but it's almost as if God adds another clue to that idea that the son, the true son, is Isaac and not Ishmael. Because did you notice in this passage that even though it says in verse 11, the thing was very grievous in Abraham's sight because of his son, but that's not what God calls Ishmael. Verse 12, "God said unto Abraham, let it not be grievous in thy sight because of," not your son, "the lad," he says. Verse 17, "God heard the voice of the lad." End of the verse. "For God hath heard the voice of the lad." Verse 18, "Arise, lift up the lad." Verse 19, "She filled with a bottle of water and gave the lad drink." Verse 20, "And God was with the lad." But it never says that he was with Abraham's son, Ishmael. God doesn't call Ishmael in these verses Abraham's son. He simply describes him as the lad. The son, the only son, the true son, the rightful son. The son who was the heir was Isaac. That's the promise, isn't it, of Genesis. Now, when we come to Genesis chapter 25, that plays out into the circumstance of how Genesis 25 tells us what happened at the time of the death of Abraham and the matter of the two sons. Because we're told in verse 5 of Genesis 25 that Abraham gave all that he had unto Isaac, but unto the sons of the concubines which Abraham had, Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac, his son, while he yet lived, eastward unto the east country. Now, this is the east country, isn't it? So the east country, if this is the land of Israel, then sending them east sent them into that vast Arabian peninsula that we've looked at this afternoon in terms of plotting where Sheba and Dedan might have been. So the sons of the concubines, it says, were all sent east. Who were the sons of the concubines? Well, clearly the sons of Keturah, as mentioned in the first few verses, but so also Ishmael, because he's one of the sons of the concubines. So Ishmael, in common with the other boys, are all sent eastwards, away from the promised land and away from Isaac. And unto Isaac, Abraham gives all that he has. So in fact, how it settled out was that Isaac stays up here in the land and Ishmael moves over here. Ishmael migrates to the great Arabian Peninsula in fulfillment of Genesis chapter 25 and verse 6. He goes eastward into the east country. And in fact, if we were to look at that east country in a bit more detail, and we've already looked at this in our workshops today, if in fact we brought up the Arabian Peninsula, you'd find that in fact it's broken into three principal sections. There was Arabia Deserta, which was the northern part, and it sounds exactly like it sounds, Arabia Deserta, the deserted Arabia, and that's where Kedar settled. There was Arabia Petraea, which means rocky Arabia, which was where Midian principally settled. And there was also Arabia Felix, which is where Sheba was, down in the south, as we discovered on our chart today. And these sons are all subsets from, well, from what happened in the story of Genesis chapter 25. Now, I just want you to bear those names in mind, Sheba and Midian and Kedar, but in fact, Kedar is the particular name that we're going to focus on for purposes of our study tonight. And yes, it's very much related to the matter of Arab hostility against Israel. So in fact, what this chapter goes on to say in Genesis chapter 25, it says this, maybe if we just sort of outline a few of the tribes here. If I just put a sort of breakup of what happened here, first of all, we had Hagar, and of course, from Hagar comes Ishmael. And you notice that verse 13 of Genesis 25 tells us the sons of Ishmael by their names, according to their generations, the firstborn of Ishmael, Nebaioth, and Kedar, and Abdeel, and Mibsam, and Mishmar, and Jumar, and Masser, and Hadar, and Timur, and Jeter, and Naphish, and Kedemer. So here's the sons of Ishmael, whole list of them here. Coming right down, these are the offspring of Ishmael, who all became tribes, every one of them, Arabian tribes that moved and migrated into the depths of that Arabian peninsula. But intermingling with that, and that's something that some of the groups noticed in their research today, we also have from Abraham the sons of Keturah. And she bare Zimran and Jokshan and Medan and Midian and Ishbak and Shuah. But also out of there came the sub-branch of Sheba and Dedan, and also Ashurim and Letushim and Leumim, and also, in fact, Ephar and Epher and Hanok and Abidar and Eldaiah. There was quite a bunch of them, really. And what happened is that all of these sons of the concubines were sent away into the eastern country. So it's not surprising why they intermingled. Because Genesis 25 says all the sons of the concubine were sent away into the same area, eastwards into the Arabian Peninsula, which is why we believe that the offspring of Hagar via Ishmael and the offspring of Keturah, in the end, all intermingled in the Arabian Peninsula. But many of these names, right across this, became vitally important Arabian tribes. Now, of all of those tribes, I want to talk about that one tonight. Just the tribe of Kedar, who was the second born of Nebaioth, because he became one of the principal tribes of the Arabians. Let me just show you where I think that tribe was in terms of its location. If you come to Jeremiah chapter 3, do you remember how that off the coast of Israel we've got the land of Cyprus, sort of out this way here? And if I just sort of put over here another circle, in the book of Jeremiah in chapter 3, I think it alludes to this idea, is it says in that place, and I'm reading from, now is it chapter 3? No, sorry, it's chapter 2, it's Jeremiah chapter 2. In verse 9 of Jeremiah 2, it says, "Wherefore I will yet plead with you, saith Yahweh, and with your children's children will I plead, for pass over the isles of Kittim and see." Now, what was the Isle of Kittim? Anybody know? It was Cyprus, okay? So it was out in the Mediterranean. "Pass over the Isle of Kittim and see, and send unto Kedar, and consider diligently, and see if there be such a thing. Has a nation changed their gods, which are yet no gods, but my people have changed their glory for that which doth not profit?" So I think what the prophet means in verse 10 when he says, "Pass over the isles of Kittim and see," he means travel westwards. And now he says, go the other way, travel west, travel eastwards, which he couches by saying, "And send unto Kedar." So go westwards, send to Kittim, or go eastwards, go to Kedar, see if you can see such a thing as the terrible thing that my people of Israel have done. If you went east or west, you'd never see such a thing. But Kedar is therefore to be deemed to be eastwards of Israel, by virtue of that phrase, I think, in Jeremiah. And in fact, what happened was the Kedarites became one of the dominant tribes of this region. So they sort of started here, on the border of what would be modern Iraq. You know how Iraq comes down to this Persian Gulf area? And they basically expanded and grew from there. So they became a dominant tribe in this particular region. In fact, let me show you how dominant they became. If you come to the prophecy of Ezekiel and chapter 27, we're told in the list of nations that traded with Tyre in Old Testament times, the record says this. Ezekiel chapter 27 says, and maybe starting from verse 20 for connection, since it's a name we're now familiar with, "Dedan was thy merchant in precious clothes for chariots. Arabia and all the princes of Kedar, they occupied with thee in lambs and rams and goats, and these were they thy merchants." So the Arabians were nations that actually were pastoral. They kept large flocks out in the desert, and Kedar was famous for their flocks. But I'm going to read verse 21 again, because I think it perhaps should be read this way, and I'm going to give you some evidence for this. How I read it was, "Arabia and all the princes of Kedar, they occupied with thee in lambs and rams and goats." But in fact, I rather suspect that this verse should be read as follows: "Arabia and all the princes of Kedar." In other words, that Kedar became such a dominant tribe that it almost is interchangeable with that word Arabia. That all of the Arab nations could be gathered up into the word Kedar. That Kedar was like a representative term. Kedar represented all the Arabian people who occupied in the trading city of Tyre. Now, let me give you some evidence for that, because that might sound like mere assertion. But this is a very interesting extract from Smith's Bible Dictionary, which sets the scene for this particular tribe, the tribe of Kedar, which you'll remember was the second born of Ishmael. And this is what Smith's Bible Dictionary says. He says, Kedar was the second in order of the sons of Ishmael and the name of a great tribe of the Arabs, settled on the northwest of the peninsula, which is what he means by here, the northwest of the peninsula, still eastward of Israel, and on the confines of Palestine. They were always looking with covetous eyes in this direction towards that land. Kedar was a far-stretching tribe penetrating into the Arabian Peninsula. The archers and warriors of the tribe were engaged in many of the wars which the men of the East waged with Israel. Interesting, by the way, if you've ever come across that phrase, the men of the East, you suddenly realize, that must be a connection with Genesis 25, that Abraham sent the sons of the concubines away eastward into the East country. So that's the men of the East. It's all those Arabian tribes who battled against Israel in Old Testament times. The sons of Ishmael and Keturah, of whom Kedar was one of the greatest, and in fact one of the most warlike of all the Arabian tribes. Kedar was famous for their battles and for their archers and warriors. As a link between Bible history and Mohammedan traditions, the tribe of Kedar is probably found in the people called the Kedjai by Pliny. And here's the interesting thing. Kedar is the ancestor of Muhammad himself. Through him, the ancestry from Ishmael is carried. So one of the interesting things about the tribe of Kedar is that the prophet Muhammad, who established the Muslim or Islamic faith, derived his descent from this tribe and from this man, from Kedar. So there's an interesting connection here that brings us, if you like, into latter days. Kedar was the progenitor of the prophet himself. And lastly, it says, the tribe seems to have been one of the most conspicuous of all the Ishmaelite tribes, and hence the rabbins call the Arabians universally by this name, Kedar. Now that's exactly what Ezekiel 27 verse 21 says. Calls all the Arabians by the name Kedar. So when it says Arabia and all the princes of Kedar, it's almost as if they're interchangeable terms. Now I think that hidden behind that statement in Smith's Bible Dictionary, not that Smith says this by the way, but this is my caption for it because it leads into what's going to happen. I think that Kedar represents the radical spirit or the spirit of radical Shiite Islam. And what I'm going to suggest, as you'll remember earlier on in our investigations this afternoon, do you remember how I mentioned that as it's turned out, the Islamic world has divided into two sections and almost sort of confining on Israel and to the north and south of them. And so up here, we've got, if you like, the principal Shiite faith, and down here we've got Sunni. And the interesting thing about the Sunni is that they are more moderate Arab nations, and they come into the peninsula in modern times where most of these states like not so much Yemen but Oman, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Dubai, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Bahrain, all of those states are moderate Sunni nations. Whereas up here in Iraq and Iran and Syria, we've got a much stronger Shiite contingent. So we've got this divide in the Islamic world. Now, I think there's two very interesting observations that I wanted to make about this. The first is that I believe that in a sense, what this means is that we've got again, amazingly, the king of the north. And we've got the king of the south, almost like a set of, you know, of powers emerging again at the time of the end in terms of that cleavage line that occurs even inside the Arab world. You've got a cleavage to the north and to the south of Israel. Now, if you imagine that to those two, this was like the Seleucids and the Ptolemies of old, right? Now, all of a sudden, we had an Arab world and we had Israel, and no one saw all of that. But suddenly, Daniel 11 comes into play. At the time of the end, shall the king of the north come against him? And you suddenly realize that there's going to be a king of the north and a king of the south power reaching right into the time of the end. Except the makeup of those won't be Seleucid and Ptolemy anymore, will they? What will they be? And the answer is that the King of the North power in its totality, I think, is going to be the Shiite Islamic group and Roche and her confederates. Whereas the King of the South is going to be the moderate Sunni group and the and Tarshish and her associates. So we've got part of the blue line, red line community here. This is the community of Gog, and this is the community of those that will oppose Gog, and we've got the King of the North and the King of the South. We've also got Shiite versus Sunni. And I think also, if I was to put Arab names on these, what would you call these? And the answer is, I think we'd call this group, from an Arab perspective, we'd call them the Kedar group. That's really the burden of tonight. And what would you call this group down here? I think we'd call them the Sheba group. Because if we go through and track through the idea of Sheba, we see that Sheba, which is an Arab name, seemed to be in friendly relations with Israel. But the history of Kedar from time immemorial is that they have everlastingly been hostile to Israel. So isn't that astonishing how that the map of world events today is unfolding, perhaps in a way that we didn't expect, but the old King of the North, King of the South blocks are emerging again, with an Arab base at their core and other surrounding nations that come into play in those two areas to form two power blocks, just like we'd expect from Daniel chapter 11. And I think that's one of the astonishing things about Bible prophecy. Sometimes we absolutely don't know how the prophecy is going to outwork, but when it does, we shake our heads with astonishment and wonder and thanksgiving that clearly the Father is in control. And although we didn't know how on earth this was all going to happen, all of a sudden it does, and things start to crystallize. And it would be true, as I said this afternoon, don't you think, is that most of that, I don't think we were very clear on as a community 10 years ago. Now all of a sudden we see it. And so perhaps one of the lessons of this weekend is that if we start to become alert to Bible prophecy, we need to be alert to developments in those two areas consistent with that idea. I very much expect that we'll see further developments in that regard. Well, that spirit of Kedar, on more than one occasion, was the spirit of Kedar doing battle against Israel. And you know, every time they did battle, I think it goes all the way back to that Ishmaelite promise, you see, unto thy seed will I give this land. Who was the promised seed? Was it Ishmael or was it Isaac? Now remember how we discovered that in Genesis chapter 21, Sarah says, and Isaac shall thy seed be called. Well, in fact, Sarah says, cast out the bondwoman, and God says, do it, because in Isaac shall thy seed be called. Of course, you know what the... You know what the Arab faith teaches from the Quran? Teaches the very reverse. Teaches not only that Ishmael was the promised seed, but that Ishmael was the son that Abraham took up onto the mountain to slay. Not Isaac, but Ishmael is Quranic teaching. And that Ishmael is the son who showed obedience. That Ishmael was the faithful son and therefore worthy of being the seed and inheritor of his father. And the whole story of the Quran is the exact opposite of what goes on in the Bible. You think, what have I got here? It's like a mirror image. It's the reverse. It's the counterfeit. It's the opposite. And it's not the truth. But that's what Arabs believe, because they've been taught that since the time of the Quran from Muhammad, who in turn derives his ancestry from this man Kedar. So as time has unfolded, since the establishment of the State of Israel, we've had quite a few battles. We've had the 1948 War of Independence. We've had the 1956 Sinai-Suez Campaign. For the 1967 Six-Day War. As we come through these, you see it's interesting how, you know, life changes. You know, one of the most interesting things about life, if I can put it that way, I'm not sure if that's quite the right thing to say, but one of the most interesting observations that I might make about life, and I'll just put it on this board here, if we just imagine we've got a wee bit of space over here by itself, is the world's actually going like this. If you're born there and you come into a world that's got that standard of behaviour and conduct and moral integrity and decency, when it gets to there, you say the world's declined. But if you were born there and only ever grew up knowing that, you say, no, it hasn't. Because what you grew up into was the norm of that time. And 20 years later, teenagers say, well, this is okay. And their grandparents say, oh, look, the world's terrible compared to what it was when we were young. And those young people have got no idea that the world's actually going downhill. The trouble is, the truth might be going downhill as well. Of course, it'll be above the world, won't it? It won't be below. But it's actually tracking down in common with the world. But because it's the gap between that and the world, they think it's okay. But in fact, the truth may have been declining as well. Everything that we have in our lives is governed by the limitations of our own perspective of knowledge. The reason why I mention that is that, can you imagine how the brothers and sisters in our ecclesias must have felt when they saw Israel coming into a nation again? Can you imagine how Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts would have felt if they'd still been alive? They would have been doing absolute cartwheels. They would have been just beside themselves. They would have been racing up and down the countryside holding lecture after lecture. They dreamed of this. They'd expounded it. They'd promised it. They'd researched it in the Bible. They believed it passionately, and they never saw it. And another generation did. A generation of brothers and sisters witnessed the day when the state of Israel was declared. Brothers and sisters wept all over the ecclesial world, wept for joy that God's promises were certain. Was the most astonishing thing. Same thing in the 1956 Suez campaign. Brothers and sisters were glued to their radio sets, because that's probably what it was in those days. Glued to the news to hear what was going to happen. And so relieved to hear that there was finally a victory that accrued to Israel. In 1967, there was a gigantic leap in baptisms. Isn't that strange? Immediately after the Six-Day War, there was a spike in baptisms all over the ecclesial world. People thought the end of the world had come and Christ was at the door. So there was a raft of baptisms everywhere. Because these were exciting things. Because this witnessed the development of the state of Israel. This witnessed the return of Jerusalem back to the control of the Jewish people. These were momentous times. Prophecy was fulfilling. So hands up here, those that are born after 1967. And most of you say, yeah. So what? Israel, yeah, we know as a nation. Control Jerusalem, yeah. But you see, you've never grown up in a world where that actually wasn't a reality. Older brothers and sisters actually lived through that and understood the joy and the amazement of that. We grew up and we just accepted it as the norm, but it wasn't the norm. God intervened. God's angels were at work in such a dramatic way that not only was the ecclesia astonished, but the world was amazed. A nation back from the dead. Not possible, they said, but it did. So as we come through these realities in our lives, we need to be so aware of Bible prophecy that we're just as touched and amazed by things that have already gone in the past. And don't just treat them as the norm because they're in existence. These are signs of God's handiwork. The Yom Kippur War, the Day of Atonement War, where it all went so horribly wrong, but they rescued victory out of probable defeat. The 1982 Galilee War. I don't think I've got any more on that particular screen, but the point I suppose I was making there was every decade the nation was struggling to fight to live. Every decade, another battle. And this was the Arabs, wasn't it? And so the Arabs came, and they came from everywhere. Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, outnumbered 3-1, 5-1, 7-1. It was Brother John Martin that said, concerning the 1967 war, he says, we believe special things happened in that war. He says, bullets went round corners. That war should never have been won by Israel. But God overshadowed it. I think he overshadowed all of those wars. Now, you see, you've lived through some of those. But the reality is that the history of the nation is still remarkably young and remarkably fresh in terms of Bible prophecy being fulfilled in our own very time. Now, come to the book of Isaiah and let me show you an interesting passage. It's Old Testament, and I'm not suggesting a New Testament application specifically. Although I might be, because, well, see what you think. I think there's certainly a Bible imperative for seeing the Spirit as still being at work. In the 120th Psalm, it says in verse 1, it's a song of degrees, says it's actually a Psalm of David about Doeg, who'd represent a good counterpart or archetype of the Spirit of Kedar. So Psalm 120, verse 1, in my distress I cried unto Yahweh, and he heard me. Deliver my soul, O Yahweh, from lying lips and from a deceitful tongue. What shall be given unto thee, or what shall be done unto thee, thou false tongue, sharp arrows of the mighty with coals of juniper? And now the prophet cries, the psalmist cries, in his distress, "Woe is me that I sojourn in Mesek, that I dwell in the tents of Kedar," he says. Oh, did you notice that? Now, the word Mesek there is the same word translated Meshek in Ezekiel chapter 38. So what he says, do you know how I feel in terms of all this hostility that Doeg manifests against me? He says, it's as if I sojourn in Meshek. Or, to put it another way, it's as if I'm living in the tents of Kedar. In other words, I think that what the psalmist meant was that he couldn't think of two stronger epithets at that moment of time to express how vulnerable he felt to all that was going on about him. He felt attacked on every side. He says, it's like living in the tents of Kedar, he says. Now, what an amazing psalm to demonstrate the spirit of hostility of the Arab people, even in these latter days, after the spirit of Kedar of old. The nation of Israel today feels like they're sojourning in Meshek and dwelling in the tents of Kedar. There's battles on every side. See what the psalmist goes on to say? He explains what that spirit is. "My soul hath long dwelt with him that hateth peace. I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war." That was the spirit of Kedar, you see, right from the beginning. War, war, and more war. That's the spirit of Kedar, and I think that is alive and well today. Not just in Hezbollah, not just in Hamas, but in the Palestinian people as a whole. And perhaps in the wider Arab community, that hostile spirit of Kedar, spoken of by the psalmist, is still there. In fact, those two verses are excellent, really. Do you know what Israel tried to do after every one of these wars? Tried to sit down with the Arabs and negotiate peace. "I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war." And do you know what the standard formula was of the Arab powers after the Battle of Independence, after the Suez Campaign, after the Six-Day War? Do you know what the standard approach was to the Arab nations involved in those battles? They had a threefold approach to how they would handle Israel. No peace with Israel, no negotiation with Israel, no recognition of Israel. Is that the spirit of Kedar? Absolutely. "I dwell in the tents of Kedar," cries the psalmist, in the lament of his distress and bitterness. And I suggest that that spirit is the very spirit of radical Shiite Islamic hostility against Israel that we see today. In that sense, I think there's a latter-day application, at least of that spirit. Now, interestingly enough, where does Kedar sit? In the territory of Iraq, Saddam Hussein's territory. I'm not making anything more of it than to say that that's an interesting place for Kedar to be historically based, because certainly whoever sits in that area hasn't been exactly friendly towards Israel up till recent times. And what's all this about? What do you think this battle's all about? All these wars? Well, I'll tell you what it's about. I'll tell you how we know what it's about, because these are some extracts from the Palestinian National Covenant. So this focuses from the Arab community down to just those in the land. Actually, I just want another, just a little digression before I do that. You don't want to be taken in by, you know, public messages. Some of you will know, not all of you will know, up till the year 1948, the word Palestinian always referred to a Jew. Did you know that? The word Palestinian up till 1948 referred to a Jew who lived in Palestine, not an Arab. So what happened in 1948 is there was a battle. Battles tend to have winners and losers. Israel won. The Arabs lost. They shouldn't have. They had seven armies massed against the Israelis, but somehow the Israelis won. What the Arabs did is they put out a radio broadcast, which Arabs are quite fond of doing. They said, "The great Arab army is going to launch a wonderful, glorious victory against the Israeli state. We will drive them into the sea. So in the meantime, leave your villages, disappear, go, because in just a few weeks, days, you'll be back in your villages and all will be well." So the Arab community left en masse, at least a whole bunch of them, 600,000 left. Except the radio was wrong. They didn't drive them into the sea. Israel won. And those 600,000 Arabs that fled became the famous Palestinian refugees. Do you know how they were defined as refugees? You'd think, wouldn't you, that all these people had been cruelly torn from their homeland where they'd lived for centuries, that it was, you know, a pretty rough deal, huh? Actually, the rule that the United Nations gave to define a Palestinian refugee in 1948 was, be in the land for 2 years, you qualify as a Palestinian refugee. Do you know why there were so many Arabs in the land at that particular time? Because of Jewish business and Jewish commerce and Jewish factories and Jewish shops that created employment. And Arabs flooded into Palestine because of Jewish enterprise. So a lot of these Palestinian refugees that were cruelly torn from their ancient homeland had been there for all of 24 months. So 600,000 were dispossessed. That's part of the unfairness, if you like, or the cruelty of war. And the world ever since has heard about the 600,000 Jewish Palestinian refugees. By the way, where did they go? They went to the surrounding Arab nations. Do you know what the Arabs did with them? Stuck them all in concentration camps. Well, they didn't call them that. They called them refugee camps. But they look the same, and they feel the same. Do you know why they put them in refugee camps? Well, they never, ever wanted those refugees to assimilate with their own nation, because the moment they assimilated, the argument's gone for the need to return to the land. So they kept them as refugees on purpose. They're blood Arab brothers. Do you know that in the next 30 years, there was argument after argument after argument in the United Nations about these poor, dispossessed 600,000 Palestinian refugees that had been torn from their land. Actually, they went at the invitation of the Arab radio station, but you know, that's another story. Actually, that's true, because the Israelis said, don't go. The Israelis implored them not to go. Don't leave. Don't go. But they went anyway because they believed the Arab propaganda. What's not often promulgated, and the United Nations is very good at not promulgating the Israeli side, in fact they have an excellent record of promulgating the Arab view and not the Israeli one, is that during the next 30 years, about 600,000 Jewish refugees left Arab lands and came to Israel. When they came, they lost all their lands, all their money, all their bank accounts, all their art collections, all their treasures, all their diamonds, all their bank deposits. Those Arab governments took everything. They arrived penniless as true refugees. And some of those had lived in some of those Arab nations for centuries and centuries and centuries. But in the end, because of persecution, they fled as refugees to Israel. 600,000 Arabs went out. 600,000 Israelis arrived in, I'd say that's probably even Stevens, wouldn't you? But you never hear the end of the story of the famous poor Palestinian refugees. It's a political issue, purely political, to keep the focus on getting that piece of land back, because they've believed since the days of Ishmael and certainly from the time of Kedar that it belongs to them. So here's some stuff out of the Palestinian covenant. Palestinian Arab people possess the legal right to its homeland. Legal right? Really? Don't know where the document is, but apparently that's what they believe. The legal right to its homeland. When the liberation of its homeland is completed, it will exercise self-determination. That's Clause 3 of the Palestinian National Covenant. Clause 9, armed struggle is the only way to liberate Palestine. Clause 15, the liberation of Palestine is a national duty to repulse the Zionist imperialist invasion from the great Arab homeland and to purge the Zionist present from Palestine. Clause 22, Israel is a constant threat to peace. The liberation will liquidate the Zionist presence and bring peace. See the key word? Our homeland, our homeland, our homeland. This is all a battle about the land. Who owns the land? Who's the promised seed of Abraham? That battle's never stopped. It's a biblical one. It's a land ownership one. And if there's to be any future Arab conflict, which there might well be, I'm not suggesting there won't be, that's what it's about. It's always been a controversy about the land. So you see what the solution is that they propose? Repulse the Zionist, purge the Zionist, liquidate the Zionist. That sounds like really friendly negotiations, doesn't it? Let's live side by side and figure out a way through this to live happily ever after. No, the doctrine is that we will only be happy when two things have happened. We want all the land, all of it, not part of it, all of it. And we want all the Israelis extinguished, exterminated, destroyed, gone. Pretty difficult to negotiate that with it, isn't it? You know, and the world says to Israel, you should negotiate to Israel. Sit down, negotiate, try. Well, you try negotiating with people whose stated objective is to liquidate you. See how you get on with negotiations. It ain't easy. It's not easy at all. Yes?
Why do you think, with relation to Bible prophecy, that is the case. I mean, if this was any other country, right, even if it was America, England,
yeah.
any of the European nations, right, they would just go to war and be done with it because, you know, they'd say, look, this is fairly reasonable. These people want to fight. We've tried, so we're going to fight. We'll be done with it. But the world doesn't see it that way at all. Like you said, the media yeah. just sort of portrays this, oh, yeah. poor Palestinian thing, right?
Yeah.
How do you think that fits with Bible prophecy? Why do you think that keeps that attitude is...
Okay, well, I think that's a very good question. Tim, did you want to add something to that?
I wonder about, we get that repetition throughout the prophets, that you're my witnesses, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
Constant testimony to that, perhaps?
Exactly, and I think that's very much the case. Is that Israel is always to the forefront, isn't it, of the news? It's an astonishing thing for its relative size. This whole controversy is always at the forefront. But it's like as if Israel itself can never solve their problems. You know, no matter how much... Israel has bent over backwards to do things the right way, and they can't win even then. I mean, many of you will have seen all of the propaganda where you'll have Arabs that have been, you know, blown up and carted off in stretchers from some rocket that Israeli, you know, has, you know, I mean, I've seen some terrific footage of all these, you know, Hamas people have been, you know, carted off dead because of an Israeli rocket that exploded. And then you'll see the same chap getting up off the stretcher and running around to jump on the stretcher to be a dead person for the next person that's being carted. And the whole thing's just a complete, it's just all nonsense. It's a complete spoof. But the world falls for it every time. It's just astonishing. The PLO have mastered the art of media manipulation. The Israelis, in this particular capacity, haven't. But what that's all about is this fundamental controversy of biblical times that, frankly, isn't resolved yet, at least not as far as the sons of Ishmael are concerned. And yet the strange thing is that although they're on about the homeland, the homeland, the homeland that belongs to us, you know, it would probably be a really good idea if they read their own Bible, because... this is what the Quran teaches. Surah 5, it's like a chapter. Remember the words of Moses to his people, the children of Israel, enter, O my people, into the holy land which God hath destined for you. Not for the Arabs, for the children of Israel. That's the Quran, Surah 5. Surah 7, and we gave to the people the eastern and western lands, which we had blessed as an heritage, and the good word of thy Lord was fulfilled on the children of Israel. Eastern and western lands, either side of the Jordan. Surah 10, moreover, we prepared a settled abode for the children of Israel and provided them with good things. And lastly, Surah 17, and thereafter we said to the children of Israel, dwell securely in the promised land, and when the last warning will come to pass, we will gather you together. That's the actual teaching of the Quran on the rightful ownership of the land of Israel. Isn't that interesting? But clearly, somewhere along the line, since the time that Muhammad wrote the Quran, the view of the Arabs has changed, at least in terms of their mullahs, and they're not teaching that particular doctrine or idea anymore. They're back to the ancient spirit of Kedar. So I think that what we've got is, in fact, a humanly impossible situation to resolve. You've got the spirit of Kedar, which will never give up. You've got the spirit of Israel, which intends to never give in. And so you've got, in effect, a stalemate that no one seems to be able to find their way through or break out of. You going to raise a comment?
So is that view then, the modern-day view that contrasts with the Quran, is that strictly held by the Shiites, though?
No, I think that even the Sunnis would tend to follow it, because I think the point is, I'm not sure that a lot of... they'd have an answer to it. The answer is they think, well, the Jews forfeited all that because they've been wicked. Mm-hmm. So they've lost all of that because they were wicked. It's our place now, because we've been faithful. Arabs are always faithful. Never such a thing as wickedness in their midst, so it's all ours. So, but it's interesting, isn't it, how these sorts of controversies perpetuate themselves down through time. So, in fact, I think the only way out of the impasse is some form of divine confrontation. And so, in terms of the Arab conflict, let me just go back to the start of the exercise. Do you think Ezekiel 38 provides the basis for seeing any Arab involvement in the controversy of Gog? The answer is I don't think so, because the only two Arab names mentioned are Sheba and Dedan, and they don't seem to appear as foes of Israel in that chapter. They very much appear to be friends who are in fact trading amicably with them in the region. So Ezekiel 38 itself doesn't seem to provide any possibility for an Arab controversy being the great issue of the time of the end. And in fact, the more you look at the passages that brothers and sisters bring up in support of this, the more you realise that, in fact, they're not very strong at all. Perhaps the strongest one that they think they bring up is Psalm 83, which mentions 10 nations that suddenly gets translated into the 10 toes of Nebuchadnezzar's image, which is a lot of codswallop, really. It's got absolutely nothing to do with it, because the 10 toes of Nebuchadnezzar's image are all about European prophecy. It's got nothing to do with Arab nations. And then you start reading Psalm 83 more carefully, and you find that the bulk of the nations mentioned in Psalm 83 are not Arab nations at all. And then you find that if it was a latter-day prophecy, that Egypt and Syria and key Arab nations aren't even involved. And then you start realizing that, in fact, this was an historical prophecy in the days of Jehoshaphat, which was fulfilled, and we can prove it. And whether there's a latter-day application is actually a matter of debate. And you suddenly realize that Psalm 83 is not conclusive at all for the very thing for which it's pressed into service, which is not just an Arab battle, but that the Arabs will defeat the Jews. And the bulk of the people that believe in an Arab controversy at the time of the end don't just believe that the Arabs will fight Israel, they believe the Arabs will win. So you've had brothers praying for that in the meeting. And you've had other people praying that in a previous controversy of the Arabs versus Israel, that Israel will be saved, and other people praying that the Arabs will win because they see that as the next stage of Bible prophecy. That's not good. So all I really wanted to say in this conjunction tonight is there the possibility of further Arab controversy? Absolutely. Could there be another battle? Absolutely. Is that the main affair of prophecy at the time of the end? Absolutely not. Now think about it. What were the great controversies of the past? Babylon. Babylon invaded the land. Did anyone join Babylon to wreak vengeance on Israel? And the answer is yes, we believe so. Some of the outlying nations joined forces with Babylon, and they used the attack of Babylon as an excuse to get even with Israel themselves. Did that happen in the time of the Roman invasion? Yes, it did. But you see, in both cases, it was the Babylonian invasion and the Roman invasion that was the real story of prophecy at that moment of time. It's not to say that other people weren't there and participating in the action. It's not to say there might not have been some Arab nations with Babylon and with Rome. Do you think there might be some Arab nations with the King of the North when he comes down? Absolutely. We'd expect the Shiite Arab nations to be absolutely part of that seed of the serpent, red lion, Gogian controversy battle that takes place. They'll join in for the fun. I've got no doubt that that's the case. They're doctrinally committed to it. But a separate, distinct, standalone Arab battle with Israel as the great prophetical event of the last days, I don't think we've got biblical warrant to in fact believe that. But notice that we would never be wise to say, therefore there'll never be another battle between the Jews and the Arabs, because, well, that could easily happen. And it might, in fact, be part of the way that leads forward to the resolution of this. So let me work this through for you from a biblical perspective. If you come to the book of Isaiah in chapter 21, and we should finish because I see that our time has gone, in Isaiah 21, here's just two or three interesting references that show how the story finishes in terms of that controversy, and maybe this is why we suggest that there is some degree of latter-day application. Isaiah 21 verse 13 is a prophecy about the burden upon Arabia. It says, "In the forest in Arabia shall ye lodge, O ye travelling companies of Dedanim. The inhabitants of the land of Timar brought water to him that was thirsty. They prevented with their bread him that fled." So where was Timar? Down here in the Arabian Peninsula. And what we're told in this prophecy, verse 14, is there are some coming into this region that are thirsty and hungry, and they're going to be given water and bread. But whereas our authorized version says that this will occur, a number of other translations have it in the Hebrew as being in the imperative tense. Do you know what I mean by the imperative tense? So, for example, the Jerusalem Bible says, for verse 14, "Bring water for the thirsty, you inhabitants of Timar. Go and meet the fugitive and give him bread." In other words, it's a command. It's an order. Now, who do you think out of the blue would give an order to the Arabians dwelling in the Arabian Peninsula to give bread and water to them that flee? Who on earth would be giving that command? And the answer is, I think this is the return of Christ. and that those who flee are in fact Jews who flee into the Arabian Peninsula because of the Gogian Confederacy of, why? Surprise, surprise, Ezekiel 38. And that one of the consequences of that is that Jewish people flee eastwards into this region, and in fact the commandment of Christ comes to these very people that they must in fact help the Jews on this occasion. For, verse 14, they prevented with their bread him that fled, for they fled from the swords, from the drawn sword, from the bent bow, and from the grievousness of war. They are fleeing from the invasion of their land, I think, in Ezekiel 38. This is the very timetabling of this particular prophecy in Isaiah chapter 21. And now see what the prophet says. Verse 16, for thus hath the Lord said, within a year, according to the years of an hireling, and all the glory of Kedar shall fail. Ah, there's our key word for tonight. All the glory of Kedar shall fail. One other translation says, within 1 year, as a servant bound by a contract would count it. How do you think a servant counts a contract when he's being paid wages and it runs for a year? Do you think he's aware of the time ticking out? He knows down to the last minute of the last hour of the last day of the last week of that contract when that contract finishes, doesn't he? So what God is saying is there's a moment coming in the future, within 1 year, a specified point of time in the purpose of God, when all the glory of Kedar shall fail. Be certain, says God, that this thing is going to happen. Now, incidentally, it cannot have happened in the days of Isaiah. It cannot have happened in a year of Isaiah giving this prophecy. And I'll tell you why. Because 100 years later, in the prophecy of Jeremiah chapter 49, which we won't turn up, there's a prophecy about Kedar, who's still alive and well with all their flocks a century later. So I think that that year, the year of the hireling, when all the glory of Kedar fails, I suspect that that might be linked to this timetable as well, of Ezekiel 38. And that not only does Christ give command to this area that they should succor the fleeing Jews, but he also gives command to Kedar. They run right up against Kedar. They run right up against Christ, and it says all the glory of Kedar shall fail. Now, remember what we said about Kedar? It represents that brooding, antagonistic, warlike, hostile spirit of antagonism to Israel down through time and manifest in the latter days through Shiite Islam. What do you think the glory of Kedar is in that context? Well, the prophet tells us. See the next verse? And the residue of the number of archers, the mighty men of the children of Kedar, shall be diminished. For Yahweh, the God of Israel, hath spoken it. Isn't that a challenging thing? All the glory of Kedar shall fail. Why? Because the God of Israel has spoken it. It shall be done. What do you think the glory of Kedar is? All their bombs and rockets and tanks and guns. The whole lot of them are going to disappear. That's the glory of Kedar, the armed struggle against Israel. Do you think Hamas fits that spirit? Do you think Hezbollah fits that spirit? Absolutely. That's Kedar of old manifested in the latter times. And I think the promise of this chapter is that one day Christ is going to come and they're going to go boof like that, and Christ is going to say, enough. And it isn't just Isaiah 21. Because have a look at this. Isaiah 21 says, within a year, and all the glory of Kedar shall fail. The mighty men of the children of Kedar shall be diminished. Mind you, it doesn't say who's going to do that. It only implies it, of course. We can't be sure, can we, that it's Christ. But did you notice, interestingly enough, do you remember what those three nations were that we saw in the Arabian Peninsula, in the edges of the Arabian Peninsula? Kedar, Midian, Sheba. Remember, they represented the three points of the triangle of the Arabian Peninsula. Habakkuk chapter 3 says, he stood and measured the earth. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Who do you think that he is who stands and measures the earth in Habakkuk chapter 3? Ah, that's getting a bit more personal now, isn't it? That's Christ, isn't it? The march of Christ in the age to come. Still not sure? Try this one. Psalm 72. Before him let the men of the desert bow, and his enemies shall lick the dust. The kings of Sheba shall offer gifts. Kedar, Midian, Sheba, all come under the control of Christ at that moment, don't they? And I think that's the only way out of the puzzle. Israel's never going to win this battle. Doesn't matter. I don't think it matters how many times they fight the Arabs, they're never going to win this battle. I think only the coming of Christ ultimately can solve this controversy between the Jew and the Arab, between Isaac and Ishmael. Only then will the spirit of Kedar be dealt with. And it will be, because if you come to Isaiah and chapter 42, the record suggests that in fact is exactly what's going to happen. That out of whatever continuing Jewish-Arab conflict that occurs, and we might see more of it yet, but this is the promise ultimately of what's to come. Verse 10, sing unto Yahweh a new song, Isaiah 42, is praise from the ends of the earth, ye that go down to the sea, and all that is therein, the isles and the inhabitants thereof. Let the wilderness and the cities thereof lift up their voice. The villages that Kedar doth inhabit, let the inhabitants of the rocks sing. Let them shout from the top of the mountains. Let them give glory unto the Lord and declare his praise in the islands. This isn't just a Kedar who's been humbled. This is a Kedar who's been converted. It's not just that they've had all their armaments taken away from them. They've had a change of heart concerning their relationship to the matters of the truth. They are singing songs, not fighting wars. And the songs that they sing, verse 12, give praise and glory unto Yahweh. So there's a dramatic change going to take place in this area. And that sort of change, of course, only Christ could possibly hope to accomplish. Israel, the nation, is never going to be able to do that this side of the kingdom. Until then, the spirit of Kedar will continue against them, don't you think? Here's one last passage just to wrap up this session before we break. It's in Isaiah 60, and the promise is this. Isn't it funny how suddenly when you see things, you see them? And sometimes you've already looked at some of these passages in another light, in another connection. But here's another line of thinking you see. The record says this in Isaiah 60, verse 1, arise and shine, for thy light has come, and the glory of Yahweh has risen upon thee. This is about the future exaltation of the kingdom of Israel. We know it's the kingdom of Israel because it talks about the gates and the temple being built, about the glory of Lebanon being brought to beautify the place of the sanctuary, verse 13. Everything's going to focus on Israel in the age to come. Then verse 6 says, the multitude of camels shall cover thee, the dromedaries of Midian and Ephah, all they from Sheba shall come, and they shall bring gold and incense, and they shall show forth the praises of Yahweh. All the flocks of Kedar shall be gathered together unto thee, the rams of Nebaioth shall minister unto thee, and they shall come up with acceptance on mine altar, and I will glorify the house of my glory. Did you notice something interesting about verse 6 and verse 7? Every single name is an Arab nation. They're going to be converted. All the sons of the concubines that went eastwards into the east country and filled that whole Arabian peninsula, the whole lot of them, are going to be converted when Christ comes. So Midian and Ephah and Sheba and Kedar and Nebaioth, and here's Kedar in the middle of all this again, verse 7, all the flocks of Kedar shall be gathered together unto thee. The flocks of Kedar, the flocks of Kedar are going to be used to offer sacrifices to Yahweh in the kingdom age. The flocks of Kedar, can you imagine that? Kedarites that have spent all their lifetime in battle and hostility against Israel will present their flocks to be used in the service of worship of the God of Israel in the kingdom age. Oh, that's a dramatic change. Absolutely a dramatic change. And those sorts of dramatic changes are only possible with the powers that Christ has at his disposal. Israel can never do that. So until Christ comes, and until that promised state of things eventuates, what of an Arab confederacy against Israel? There might be one. I wouldn't want to rule out that possibility at all. But I still think that we feel comfortable that the main sweep of prophecy itself will sweep on and beyond any one of those battles that might yet occur with the Arabs to the last great event of Bible prophecy. And that's the subject of our next study.